Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Delighted to get to be with you on a Thursday afternoon, which is usually there'll be a little bit of groovy music on a Thursday afternoon. And sometimes if we get real lucky, we get 2 hours of Jimmy Akin. And this just happens to be one of those occasions. 2 hours of Jimmy Akin open forum, Thursday afternoon, July summer day. Try to beat that. Just try to beat that. You can't beat it. You're welcome to call, though, and get involved in it. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. I'm just opening up my phone app here. Every single line full already. We're like 31 seconds into the show. Every single line full. That's how it goes when Jimmy's here. Hi, Jimmy Akin. How you been?
Hi, Cy Kellett. I've been doing well.
I'm very glad to hear it. And this time I can say what's up tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, because it is actually
you can. You can say that, yes.
Oh, and I already know, too. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin.
Yeah. It's Fifth Friday, so it's Weird Questions. But do you know what the weird questions are?
No, I thought I might ask you. Like, I know we did them together, but I don't... in one ear, out the other with me. Nothing lasts very long with me. So what is it?
Well, we're going to be covering questions like, will we be frozen in time in heaven? Did Lazarus have a near-death experience? Why is the night sky dark? Oh, which is a much more interesting question than you might suspect.
Yeah.
Resurrection. What happens at the resurrection if you've fallen into a black hole? Children before the fall, what they would have been like. Also, the ship of Theseus. And if Jesus had children, would they be normal humans?
I do remember those now. I especially, it's funny when you said the night sky one, there's a little paradox involved in that I was not aware of. I had never thought of it. And it's very interesting.
It's called Olber's paradox. And it wasn't the answer to Olber's paradox was not solved until the 20th century.
All right, we'll check it out tomorrow morning. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. They drop every Friday, even when there's five Fridays. That's how devoted Jimmy is. Even when there's five Fridays in a month, you're still going to get a new one every Friday. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, did you hear me say already every single line full?
I heard you say that.
I feel like we better just go to phones.
Okay.
Let's just start answering questions. Let's go to Bryce in Utah, listening on the app, the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading it onto your phone. Bryce, go ahead with your question, please, for Jimmy.
Hey, Cy. Hey, Jimmy.
Hi,
my
Bryce.
My question is about the possibility of an infinite path. It is my understanding that God's omnipotence makes an unliftable rock an impossibility. Could it be that God's omniscience would make an infinite past also impossible, as God could always be able to apply one of the infinite finite numbers to label every past event? Could it be that finitude is in fact infinite as suggested by the existence of infinite finite numbers? Thanks for your thoughts.
I don't see why God's omnipotence or omniscience would prevent him from creating an infinite past. Now, this is not something the church has a teaching on. There have been doctors of the church who have held different opinions on this. St. Bonaventure thought that God could not create an infinite past if he chose, but St. Thomas Aquinas thought that God could create an infinite past if he chose. So you have a disagreement there between two doctors of the church who actually were contemporaries with each other. And so the question really depends on the merits of the argument philosophically, since there's no teaching on this. Personally, I've done a lot of work on this question, and even though I'm not a Thomist, I agree with St. Thomas on this. I don't see why God couldn't have created an infinite past if he had chosen. And I don't see the numerability of the moments of the past as a problem. The set of natural numbers, which is the set of numbers that go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, that set of natural numbers is itself infinite. And so you could assign a natural number to every moment of past time, whether you count a moment as a day or an hour or a second or anything you want. You could assign a natural number to each moment of the past, and there's an infinite number of natural numbers. So by that reckoning, there could be an infinite number of past moments. And by his omniscience, the fact that he knows everything, God would know the numbers of all those moments. So I don't see any inconsistency here. I don't see what would prevent God from being able to create an infinite number of past moments.
Okay, Bryce?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's just that so many atheist arguments hinge on appealing to infinite sets, like there's an infinite regression of the past, or there's an infinite amount of contingent beings, therefore no necessary being. So it would be useful if somehow infinite actualized collections were not in fact possible, but maybe they are, and we'll just have to keep looking.
Yeah, well, Aquinas would say that an infinite past is not an infinite actualized collection, at least not from the perspective within time, because there's only one moment of time from inside of time. There's only one moment of time that's real in that moment. We call that moment the present. Now, from an external perspective, like God has, being outside of time, there would be an infinite number of moments that are real. But that's something we have to deal with anyway, because there will be an infinite number of future moments. You know, there's not going to be a last moment at which point all creation ceases to exist, including us. So the fact that we are given eternal life means that we have an infinite number of future moments to live. And from God's perspective outside of time, all of those moments are real. And so we have an infinite collection there. And from God's perspective, it's real. So that's something I think we just have to deal with. There are other ways of handling atheistic arguments, but I don't think appealing to an overly simple version of infinities is the successful way to deal with it. I think we have to be more discriminating than that.
Bryce, what a great, interesting question to start us off with. Thank you very, very much. It's open forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lots of folks on the line. So we go to Megan in Wisconsin watching on YouTube. Megan, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si and Jimmy. My question relates to Calvinism. And I saw a post by a Calvinist talking about how there were early church fathers such as Clement of Rome, Athanasius, Justin Martyr, Augustine, that they kind of subscribed to Calvinism. And I was wondering if that was true or not.
Well, it's certainly not the case that any of the church fathers believed in what's today called five-point Calvinism. Calvinism is traditionally defined as having 5 points that are expressed in the acronym TULIP. Sometimes you'll have a version of Calvinism known as four-point Calvinism, which omits one of the five. But one of the things that all Calvinists, at least people who are classically called Calvinists, one of the things they all agree on is a doctrine called perseverance of the saints. And according to the doctrine of perseverance of the saints, if you ever come to God and are saved, so you enter a state of grace, God will preserve you in that state so that you can never lose your salvation. In other words, there is either no such thing as mortal sin, or if there is such a thing as mortal sin, God will never allow a saved person to commit a mortal sin. And that is something that none of the church fathers believed, including none of the people you just named. Even St. Augustine, who did have a high predestinarian view, did not believe that in once saved, always saved, or perseverance of the saints. He thought it was possible for a person to enter a state of salvation and then later leave that state of salvation. And so he would not be a Calvinist for that reason. He might have some similarities to Calvinism, but he wasn't either a 5-point or a 4-point Calvinist.
Okay, Megan?
Yeah, does that kind of tie into, like, or maybe gets rid of that idea of predestination, that idea of Calvinism, like not believing in that kind of once save, always save?
Well, it's certainly not traditional Calvinism, if you have someone who says you can enter a state of salvation and then leave it, whether you're 5-point or 4-point, Calvinists believe in perseverance of the saints, and that is not something that was taught by any of the church fathers, including St. Augustine.
And Megan, that brings us to our break, so I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very, very much for that. Lots of folks on the line. We continue with Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Faith is a precious gift from God. As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Just a couple days left to get the early bird pricing on the Catholic Answers Conference coming up the last week of September right here in San Diego. Act now. 5 days left. Take advantage of the $50 savings with our early bird special. The promo code is EARLY, and you save that $50 whenever you sign up before August 1st at midnight at CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's going to be an extraordinary conference all about Jesus in the Eucharist. Jesus will be present with us in the Eucharist. We'll have daily Mass and confessions. We'll have wonderful speakers. We'll have Eucharistic adoration and lots of fun. And we'd love it if you'd come. Go to CatholicAnswersConference.com to find out all about it and to sign up. And if you do sign up, use that promo code EARLY and save that $50. We're going to Ontario, Canada, where suddenly we are very popular. Lots of calls this week from Ontario, Canada. Justin, watching on YouTube, thanks for calling from Canada. Glad to have you, Justin. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Very well. Thank you.
My question is, I'm really into studying Second Temple Judaism. Mm-hmm. And around the time of the apostles. And I'm open to the idea that there's a distinction between fallen angels and demons. Like, demons mm-hmm. are the hybrid offspring of fallen angels and women. But in light of the Fourth Lateran Council, in light of certain things the church has said, is that permissible to hold that? Because I'm only kind of adding more details, or is that condemned?
Well, I'd have to check the wording of the Fourth Lateran Council. It's been a while since I looked at that passage, but my understanding would be that just generally, you have to look at how terms are being used in a given age and by a given language community. So the Greek term daimonios didn't originally mean what Christians mean by a demon. It originally referred to a kind of lesser spiritual being that was less than a theos, less than a full god, and one that could potentially be manipulated by humans and so forth. And so they had a different meaning for the term. Christians then picked it up, and you can argue, depending, on the evidence you have, that it shifted meaning over the course of Christian history. So in order to discern what Fourth Lateran is saying about demons, you'd have to use the term as it was used in the time of Fourth Lateran. And if they're using it as a synonym for fallen angel, well, then that's how they're using the term. That doesn't mean that it can't be used other ways. It just means this is not the way it's being used now. And today in Christian doctrine and Christian theology, the term demon is used as a synonym for fallen angel, but that wouldn't preclude there being other uses of the term that are no longer current. If you could provide evidence for it, and I know that some like Michael Heiser have proposed this, that in the first century, the term for demon was more commonly used for like the ghost of one of the children of the Nephilim. I haven't seen evidence that would document that to my satisfaction. I'm open to it. I plan to get around to studying it. I just haven't yet. But if that were the case, that would simply be a different use of the term demon than we use today.
Okay. Basically, the Fourth Lateran, as far as I understand, just basically says that God created them good. In the beginning, I kind of was able to wedge my interpretation saying, well, yeah, I mean, even if God permitted some kind of union like that, he's still the one that ultimately brings life, but they became bad anyways, and God knew they'd become bad. That was pretty much my question, in that they had, in the beginning, they had an original testing, which is like sententia certain, but I believe in three testings. I believe that, you know, Genesis 3, Genesis 6, and Genesis 11 pretty much were separate falls of different angels, whether that was also permissible.
That is also permissible. The church recognizes that demons were originally good and that some of them fell, but it does not have specific teachings about exactly when they fell or whether they all fell at once. Theologians have offered opinions about that, and the common opinion is that the angels fell very early and all of the ones who did fall fell at the same time, but that's a theological opinion that is not church teaching.
And I'm going to leave it there, Justin. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very, very much. But the lines just continue full. So on we go to Bob in Florida, also listening on the Catholic Answers app. Bob, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, Jimmy, I'm teaching RCA this session coming up, and I just saw that the change of the name of RCIA to OCIA from right to order. I have yet to find a good explanation of why that is, and I was hoping you could help me out, because I know it would be a question.
My understanding is that the reason for that is that in the Latin, it has always been referred to as using the Latin term ordo, which can be translated different ways. And originally, you know, a few decades ago, when the liturgy was first being put into English, the translations were rather loosey-goosey, and so they translated it as rite rather than more, you know, in a more etymological way as order. And they've gradually tightened things up. At least that's my memory of this change, but I could be mistaken about that. But that's my memory, that it's always been the order of Christian initiation in Latin, and now they're just adjusting the English to reflect that.
Okay, there's no difference between order or rite then.
Well, no, they're basically the same thing in this context.
Bob, thank you so much for teaching in the RCIA. Maybe I'd love to send you a book. And something that might be of help to you is Jimmy Akin's A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Because maybe as you're doing the RCIA classes, you'll come up against questions that are in that book, it'll help you answer them. So if you want to hang on the line, I'll be happy to send you Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense. I, however, am going to keep moving because I got to get as many on as I can, and there's lots on the line. Travis in Michigan watching on YouTube. You are next up, Travis. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
Si, I got to ask you, did you get my email from the other day? You and Joe were joking back and forth about your books, and I just wanted to let both of you know that I bought two copies of each of your books, so you can at least say that you have sold two books.
My mom bought one, so I'm up to three at least. But I did not get the email. Did you send it to radio@catholic.com?
No, I sent it to Si Kellett.
I think my email here is ckellett@catholic.com.
C. Kellett, yeah. I'm not sure, but...
I'll check.
But
I'm sorry. I don't remember seeing it, but I... I would remember that if you told me you bought two copies of my book. I'd definitely remember that.
Yeah. And don't feel left out, Jimmy. I have like 4 or 5 of yours, but only because I feel kind of drawn to you because you are number two of the people I've encountered in my entire life that pronounce a certain word a certain way. And my late fiance was the other one, and that word is ancient. So you hold a very special place in our lives because of that.
Well, thank you. People have told me that I pronounce ancient in a unique way, but it's just the way I grew up saying it and hearing it. I don't even hear an alternative pronunciation. I don't know anyone who would say ancient, which is how it's spelled, but nobody says it that way. So you're apparently picking up on a difference that my brain is not wired to hear.
Apparently. But I just wanted to let you know. My question, though, is I was wondering if there were any, you know, particular requirements for becoming a deacon, like necessary to be in the Catholic Church for a certain amount of time, or any schooling. Likewise, if there's anything special to become an apologist or even just a spiritual leader. I'm kind of discerning what I want to be since my fiance passed. And
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Leading towards.
Yeah. Well, one thing I would recommend, because so I'm a widower. My wife passed on, and people wondered after that happened, would I become a priest? And it was something I discerned, but I concluded that the priesthood is not the best way for me to serve God. I would recommend not making any decisions right now while you're still going through the grieving process. It's important that you take time. I mean, it's fine to think about things. But while you're in a grieving process, if you just lost a fiance, that's a really tough thing to have happen, and you need to take time to heal and, you know, restabilize before you make long-term decisions. So I would urge you not to make decisions quickly. I would wait until you've recovered from this blow. In terms of the specific question you ask, well, there are requirements for being a deacon. I don't think there's a specific one for how long you've been in the Catholic Church. Paul does say in his letters not to ordain a recent convert, and that would be applied in a practical way by the bishop of whatever diocese you would be seeking ordination in. I mean, he'd need to look at a variety of factors connected with you and see, okay, does this guy seem to be a suitable candidate? There are educational requirements, but those in the case of permanent deacons are typically met by a diaconal education program that occurs in the diocese. It takes a few years, but the diocese sees to that. In what I am aware of in canon law, this is canon 1031, section 2. It says a candidate for the permanent diaconate who is not married is not to be admitted to the diaconate until after completing at least the 25th year of age. One who is married, not until completing at least the 35th year of age and with the consent of his wife. So there is an age requirement that's written into canon law itself. But one of the things, in this area is they leave a lot to the discretion of the bishop. And so if you do reach a point where you're interested in pursuing the diaconate, or even just for your own information so you can discern that question, you might want to contact your local diocese and ask what the requirements for the diaconate are there. Because it will vary some from place to place. In terms of becoming an apologist, there is no certification for that in the Catholic Church. It's not a liturgical office. It's not part of holy orders. And so, and in practical terms, anybody can do apologetics. Not everyone can do it well, or not everyone can do it professionally, but everybody can do apologetics. And so I've written before, I think others have written before at Catholic Answers about what they've done to train in apologetics. I wrote an article on that subject a few years ago that's online at Catholic.com. You might want to look that up. More broadly, in terms of being a religious or spiritual leader, there, that's not a set office. And so it really happens in a lot of different ways. Ordinary people can be religious leaders in their families or their local communities, as long as they're, you know, leading people in the right way and in harmony with the church and church programs and under obedience to the bishops. That doesn't mean that they have a formal office, but unless they're ordained or something like that. There are also other things that one can do, like become a catechist, become an RCIA instructor, lead a Bible study at one's church. And there are frequently diocesan certifications for those, you know, to make sure that the catechists are going to teach what the church teaches and so forth. But that's something you could also pursue by contacting your diocese.
And that's the music, Travis. God bless you, brother. Thank you very much for the call. I'll look for the email. I'm still catching up from some time I was out, so I'll look for the email. But thank you very much. And lines continue full, so lots more open forum with Jimmy Akin when we continue right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Tomorrow morning on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate the feast of Saints Martha, Mary, and Lazarus and get a preview of the Sunday Mass readings with Father Hezekias Carnazzo. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
A little bit of groovy music. That makes me feel so good. A little bit of groovy music, a little bit of Jimmy Akin makes your Thursday afternoon go down smooth. It's like a spoonful of sugar. You're very welcome here. It's open forum. Jimmy's with us both. What?
So you're saying Thursday afternoon is like medicine?
Yes. Yes. And for this reason, you know what? I never thought it's the worst traffic day. Why is Thursday worse than Friday around here? It's my worst day for getting home Thursday afternoon.
Is it?
Yeah. This is fascinating. There's no lines open. But
I never have trouble getting home after the show. Yeah, I don't know why that is.
I realize that, Jimmy. Mm-hmm. I'm aware that your commute is very easy. The number is 888-318-7884. You're going to have to keep trying, though, because the lines keep filling up really quick. We'd love to take your call, and if we can get you in during those times when somebody else hangs up, we'll do that. We're going to go to Boston, Massachusetts now. Joseph in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on Catholic.com. Glad to have you with us, Joseph. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is about Romans chapter verses 25 through 26, and Paul talking about
circumcision.
If an uncircumcised doesn't keep the law, it's like he, or if a circumcised doesn't keep the law, it's like he's uncircumcised, and kind of the vice versa there. It would seem to me that, like, a lot of the history of Israel is God keeping his covenant despite his people's, like, disloyalty to it. So I'm kind of wondering what Paul's kind of saying here. It would seem like they would still be a special people set apart for God. I don't know.
Okay. So, since you cited these verses, I'll start by reading them. This in Romans 2, 25 and 26, Paul says, circumcision indeed is of value if you obey the law. But if you break the law, your circumcision becomes uncircumcision. So you won't receive any benefits just because you're circumcised. He then, in verse 26, gives the flip side of that. He says, so if a man who is uncircumcised keeps the precepts of the law, will not his uncircumcision be regarded as circumcision? And Paul's going to go on in Romans to elaborate that, talking about how circumcision is not simply a matter of being physically circumcised. That's just an external symbol of an internal purity of heart. And it's the internal purity of heart that's really important. So if you have faith working through love, then you count as a Jew spiritually, whether you're circumcised physically or not. Now, that doesn't mean that the Jewish people, considered as an ethnic group, don't have a special place before God. They actually do. And that's something that Paul explores later in Romans. If you look at chapters 9 through 11, Paul has an extended meditation on the place that the Jewish people do have in God's plan. And he also discusses in those chapters about how Gentiles who are believers in God and in Christ are grafted in to that plan. He uses an analogy of an olive tree, and he compares Jews to people who belong to a cultivated olive tree, and Gentiles to people who have been part of a wild olive tree, and then they get grafted from the wild olive tree into the cultivated olive tree when they become Christians, so they become part of the Commonwealth of Israel. Similarly, people who are in the Commonwealth of Israel, who are, you know, ethnically Jewish, if they don't believe in Jesus, if they don't do what the law says, you know, let's say they go out and murder and steal and commit adultery and things like that, then they're not going to receive benefit from being part of the Commonwealth of Israel. And that's the point that Paul is making here in Romans 2. You got to walk the walk. Just being circumcised is not enough. Also, similarly, the fact someone is not circumcised will not stop someone from participating in the Commonwealth of Israel. So circumcision, physical circumcision, has a role, but it is not the criterion of salvation, and it is not a prerequisite for salvation either.
Okay, thank you. If I could just follow up super quick. So when you say, like, walk the walk, I guess here it would seem like, yeah, so you can't murder or do – would that be separated as it is today in the church by, like, serious sin and non-serious sin, or mortal versus venial? Yeah, because Paul's, like, setting it up that no one kind of follows the law. All have fallen short of the glory of God.
Well, Paul is primarily – the law that Paul is primarily concerned with is the law of Moses. And he – so when you read about breaking the law, especially early in Romans, Paul really has in mind the law of Moses there. He also has, in some passages, and this is true in Romans 2, he also has in mind the natural law, which is written into the human heart. And he talks about how Gentiles who don't know the law of Moses can nevertheless know the law of God in their hearts and follow it. So there's kind of a complex relationship here between the law of Moses and the law of God, more generally, the natural moral law. But fundamentally, Paul is indicating that being a Jew is neither necessary nor sufficient. Being ethnically a Jew, being physically circumcised, is neither necessary nor sufficient for salvation. What really counts, as he puts it in Galatians 5, is faith in Christ working through love.
And I'm going to leave it there. Joseph, thank you very much for the call. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Onward we go now down to San Antonio, Texas. Stephen in San Antonio, listening on 89.7 FM. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy, Stephen.
Okay, my question is this. And the resurrection body that we're going to receive, we're going to never die. And I was wondering how is it going to affect our internal organs, like our heart and our kidneys and our lungs and our stomach and our digestive system, when all these organs are keeping us alive by when we eat food, it basically digests our food and assimilates it in our body. But since we no longer are going to be living off of water and food to survive or to live, does that mean our internal organs are basically going to not function anymore or no need to function? And my second question is, in the resurrected body, are we going to still be going to the bathroom after we eat?
The answer to both questions is the same. We don't know. What we do know, because we've been told, is that we will have eternal life in bodily form. But exactly what that means is something that has not been revealed to us. We're told that by St. Paul that our resurrected bodies will be much greater than our present bodies, but we're not told the details. And so it's possible that we may consume food and water and digest them, but it's also possible that we may not. One of the things that St. Thomas Aquinas talks about, and this is, of course, a matter of theological opinion, but one of the things that he talks about is how, and he doesn't use the modern word. The modern word is entropy, which refers to the tendency of a system to wear down and break down and become less organized over time. He didn't have that word because that came up after the scientific revolution, but St. Thomas Aquinas notes, in other terms, that every natural physical system that is not supported by grace is subject to entropy. And so it will wear down and break down over time. In his terms, it was corruptible. And that's the nature of every physical system that is not supported by grace. But our resurrected bodies will be supported by grace, and so they won't run down and break down over time. Now, exactly how grace will support our physical forms is something that could work in different ways. It could be that God will support us at the organ level and keep all of our organs from breaking down and corrupting, but we'll still eat food. Or it could be, instead of supporting us at the organ level, God could support us at the cellular level so that he keeps all of the cells supplied with the with what they need to keep going, and the organs don't really have to get involved. Or it could be that he'll support us at the bodily level, where neither the organs nor the cells really need to get involved in order to keep things running. We just don't know, and we'll just have to leave it to God to handle that for us, and we'll eventually find out.
And God will handle it for us.
Yeah.
Stephen, thanks very much. We've got to take a quick break. Right back with more. Jimmy Akin, Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hi, I'm Kristalina Everett, and I am so blessed to have a great new show on EWTN Radio. It's called Women Made New, where women help women get closer to God. Through honest conversations with our guests about the challenges we face in our lives, we're reminded that no matter what mistakes we've made, it's never too late to start over when we receive healing from the God who makes all things new. That's Women Made New every Saturday at 12 noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I guess we're having fun because it's just time is just flying for me this hour. I don't know how it is for you, but it's just flying for me. Lots of great questions ahead. It's open forum. By the way, 2 hours of open forum. So if you're on the line and we're not able to get to your question by the top of this hour, just hang on and we'll get to it right away in the second hour. And if you haven't been able to dial in your question this hour, but you still got one, well, you got a whole hour coming up right after this. I think we're going to Marlena in Michigan, listening on the app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Marlena, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a friend who is Protestant. I mean, when we talk about the visibility and invisibility of the church, they mm-hmm. refer to the quote that Jesus is the cornerstone. I think it's Ephesians chapter 2. And since a cornerstone is a basis and foundation of a building, some way or another, they point to the church that Jesus created is an invisible church. So I'm just hoping you can point to some evidence of the visibility of a church.
Okay. So one of the common things that happens in discussions of this nature is people will kind of camp out on their favorite verse that has to do with the foundation of the church, and they'll ignore all of the other verses that speak about it. In the case of the cornerstone passages, well, Christ is referred to as a cornerstone of the church, but a cornerstone is not the only part of a foundation. A cornerstone is the corner part of the foundation, hence the name. Sykelet, why is a cornerstone called a cornerstone?
It's over in the corner.
It's over in the corner. That's right. And you use it to orient the other stones in the foundation. And so in Ephesians, you have St. Paul saying that the church is built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets. The prophets in this case are best understood as the New Testament era prophets, people like Agabus and so forth, who were prophets in the New Testament era. And he says Christ is the chief cornerstone. So that depicts Christ as part of the foundation, but not all of the foundation. And there are other passages that use different images for the foundation of the church. In fact, there are 5 different images that are used in the New Testament. And if you go online and type in Jimmy Akin, the church's 5 foundations, you will find an article I wrote many years ago, back in like 1993, where I talk about the different passages and what they mean and how they need to be read together. You can't just read one of them to the exclusion of the others. I also talk about this in my book, A Daily Defense. In terms of the visibility of the church, well, so what does it mean for a church to be visible? Basically, it would mean it has an identifiable membership, so you can tell who's a member and who's not. It has leaders and followers, and you can tell who those are. And it has laws that govern the behavior of the members, and people can be either included from it or excluded from it by the action of the leaders. You know, they could excommunicate someone to get them out of the church. They could baptize someone to get them into the church. But that's what we're talking about when we talk about a visible church. And if you look at the 2 passages in the New Testament where Jesus himself speaks of his church, and that's Matthew 16 and also a couple of chapters later in Matthew 18, in those 2 passages, Jesus is clearly envisioning what we would call a visible church, because in Matthew 16, he appoints Peter as its leader, And there are various ways to show that that's exactly what he's doing. He also gives Peter the keys to the kingdom of heaven and says, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. That power of binding and loosing was a Jewish idiom that we know from other sources. It's not just here in the New Testament. We have it in other sources. It's the power to make and abolish laws and policies. So he's giving Peter the power to make and abolish laws and policies. That's another component of the visible church. He later shares, he doesn't share the power of the keys, but he does share the power of binding and loosing with others in Matthew 18. And also in Matthew 18, he says that if a brother, so that's someone who's in the church, if a brother sins against you, you know, you want to try to correct him personally, but if you're not able to get satisfaction, then take him to before the church. And if he doesn't listen to the church, then let him be as a Gentile or a tax collector to you, meaning someone who is not a member of the church. So that's a reference to excommunication. And so we see here, we've got leadership, we have a visible membership where people are either in or out of the church. It's not just a spiritual state. You can tell, are they a member or are they not? And we have the power to the power of lawmaking. So all of those elements of Jesus's church indicate he's talking about a visible church. And so when he says the gates, he's going to build his church and the gates of hell are not going to prevail against it, that means his church is a visible institution that has been with us since the first century. And I explore more of that in a paper that I wrote. It's on my website, jimmyakin.com. It's called Why Be Catholic, An Exercise for Evangelicals. And I go through all of that in more detail in that paper if you'd like to look it up. Again, it's called Why Be Catholic, An Exercise for Evangelicals, and it's at jimmyakin.com.
Marlena, thank you very, very much. Appreciate that question. I hope that was helpful to you. Up next, we go to Joseph in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Catholic.com. Glad to have you, Joseph. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, thank you guys for taking my call. I love you guys. Here's my question.
All right.
So in the book of Joshua, when the Israelites are attacking all the cities, are those cities like Jericho, are they all military forces, or are they just, you know, the normal villages and towns with all the civilians? I ask the question because, I mean, if it's literal that all the women and children were wiped out, then fine. But I'd rather prefer the reading that they just attacked military fortresses instead. So I was wondering what you were thinking of that.
Well, I don't have any evidence that these towns were simply military installations. They weren't like military outposts. They were towns that had people living in them who were civilians. And that certainly includes Jericho. Jericho is the oldest continuously occupied city in the world. It actually goes back a long time before the arrival of the Israelites. It's as far as we know, it's the oldest city, and it wasn't just a place for stationing officers. There were civilians who lived there. Now, the question, there is a debate about exactly how we should read the passages pertaining to extermination, because these passages were written significantly after the times when the Israelites came in. The book of Joshua was not written immediately in Joshua's time. It was written sometime later. And as a result, there may be a kind of looking back on things with a kind of holy hyperbole of, you know, we came in and we did God's will perfectly, and that meant, oh, getting rid of all paganism. Well, except we know that they didn't really literally get rid of all paganism, because paganism continued to be a problem. We even have places where it talks about, like, they exterminated the Amalekites, but then the Amalekites are still alive later on. And so there's a question about how literally some of the extermination passages are meant. And I would say that whatever happened, it did not result in all of these people being wiped out, or they wouldn't have been around later to cause problems in Israel.
Joseph, thanks very much for that question. I think I can get at least one, maybe two more on before the top of the hour, so I'm going to try to do that. Hope that was helpful. Go to New York. Oh, New York City. New York City. Austin, watching on YouTube. Go ahead with
your
question.
You're so piquant when you say that.
I am. I am piquant.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hi, Austin. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Oh, you guys hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah.
Through the magic of the telephone.
The phone dropped, so I had to call back.
Oh, well, we're glad you're here now. Go ahead.
Oh, great. So my question is, what's the difference between, and I mean like the biblical meanings of, like, difference between wishing, praying, and desiring?
Okay. Well, I would say, and I'd have to do, you know, to really answer this in a scholarly way, I'd have to go do a bunch of research. But just impressionistically, desire is the most fundamental of the three. And desire is an emotion. So when you see something, like let's say it's a piece of pizza and it smells good and it looks good and you have a desire to eat it, that's kind of the most fundamental of these three phenomena. But just because you may have a desire for something doesn't mean that you actively endorse that desire by your will. So you could have a desire, like for a piece of pizza, but say, I don't want to eat that. I'm dieting. I don't want to eat, or I'm fasting or whatever. I don't want to eat that. And in that case, you would not be wishing that you had the pizza. You might have a desire for the pizza, but you're not wishing to have it. Wishing would occur when you go beyond just having a desire, which is an emotion, and you endorse it by an act of the will and say, I would like that. I want that. I wish I had that. And then praying is when you ask for it. And if I ask, I could ask, you know, the person who's selling the pizza, and that would actually be a prayer. Originally in English, the term pray, which comes from the Latin word prex, it just meant a request. And so I could ask the pizza seller for the piece of pizza, in which case I've made a prayer of a human sort, but I also could pray to God or, you know, pray to the saints and the angels for their intercession. But in all of those circumstances, I'm going beyond merely wishing for something. I'm actually asking for something. And when I make that ask, when I make that request, that's when I'm praying.
Does that all make sense to you, Austin?
Yeah, like, I understood the wishing being, like, a thing we do, and desiring kind of be, like, unconscious. But I've seen people relate wishing to praying.
Mm-hmm. Like,
well, typically there is a wish that's behind every prayer. You know, if I pray, you know, please heal my grandmother, well, I'm wishing also that my grandmother be healed. And so wishes are behind prayers, but not every wish is a prayer. You need to take some kind of action. I mean, that goes beyond it. There is a bit of a fuzzy boundary, because there are places, like, for example, in St. Paul's letters, where he'll say things like, "Christ, have mercy on this person," and it's not clear is that an actual prayer or is it just a wish? Because the form of the language he's using is not 100% clear. And as a result, you'll sometimes see biblical scholars referring to these as wish prayers or something like that, where it's kind of on the border. It's a little ambiguous. Is he just hoping for this or wishing for this, or is he actually invoking, you know, God by saying this? And my inclination is to say he's actually invoking God. He's not talking to God directly. He's not saying, "Oh, Jesus, have mercy on this person." But by saying, may Jesus have mercy on this person, or Jesus have mercy, he is invoking Jesus. He knows Jesus is listening and is going to hear that. And I think there is a conscious element of prayer there, even if it's not expressed formally as a prayer.
Austin, we're going to have to leave it there because we are at the very end of this hour. But don't worry, if you're on the line, stay there. If you haven't called yet, you can call 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open forum. That means open to anybody and any question that you've got. I cannot remember if we've had, I don't think we've had questions from non-Christians today or non-Catholics, but you're very welcome here. If you're just curious or you want to challenge us on something, 888-318-7884. Be right back with more open forum. Lots and lots of questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.